There are many different religions in the world. And I used my good friend Gemini, who happens to be part of the AI world there, about how many different religions. Now, for example, this is what we came up with. Buddhism has about 500 million adherents. Hinduism, about 1.2 billion believers. Islam has almost 2 billion believers. But the largest grouping, religious grouping that's out there is by far the Christian world, with over 2.5 billion converts. That's almost one in three. But you know, even within these different religions, there is great variety. For example, Google will tell me that there are tens of thousands of different denominations within Christianity itself. One estimate I saw said 45,000 different denominations. Now, if you look at the 2.5 billion Christians that are out there, it says roughly 1.4 billion are Catholic. 800 million are Protestant. 500 million are evangelicals. And then you have this small leftover that's everybody else. And that's where the Church of God fits, would be in the remnants of all of these. I want you to think about something, and perhaps we haven't stopped to consider it before. All of Christianity started with one denomination. You know, and it's hard to wrap your mind around, but think of it in your mind as kind of a funnel, but an upside-down funnel. A narrow end at the top, and then it gets bigger at the bottom. Started with one single denomination. Somewhere along the line, you had a split. And then another, and then another, so on, so forth, until you get to this wide end of the funnel. And suddenly you look up, you have 45,000 denominations, all believing different things, all saying different things, all doing different things, all from a single starting point. Now, we have the privilege of understanding the truth of God. But, you know, even within the churches of God, there are different thoughts, different groups out there as well, aren't there? Most of us have gone through splits, at least one. Some of us more than one. Now, can I break it down a little further? How about within CAGWA? Wouldn't you know it, but different people have different ideas on different topics, even within CAGWA. Now, in my mind, some of that is fine. I mean, there are things out there that we're not told in the Bible exactly what should happen or what to think about different things. And in those cases, your thoughts are just as valid as my thoughts because we don't know. And as long as we don't take these thoughts and then move them up the ladder to where they become doctrinal issues, I believe we're fine to talk about these different things. But at the same time, we have to be very careful. Careful that we don't pick up some of these ideas that are common to the world around us. These things that are not biblical. We have to be careful that the impact of modern Christianity, what they teach, what they tell us, that doesn't also seep into our midst. And it can happen easily, subtly, as many times in the past. So we need to be on the lookout for these different things. And that's what I want to look at today. I want to look at one book in the Bible we're going to concentrate mostly on. It contains such a warning. And the words that we're going to look at are applicable today just as much as the time that they were written. I want to look at today the book of Jude. The book of Jude. And we don't know exactly when the book was written. It was written roughly in the time frame 65-70 AD. And at that point in time, the church was what? Still one denomination. But what you see is that cracks were beginning to appear, and you begin to see warnings beginning to appear in the writings of, for example, Paul, John, Peter, and Jude. Now, Jude is seldom considered, and yet I believe this book is very important for us today. fact, William Barclay, in his Daily Study Bible, he states this about the book of Jude. He said, when we understand Jude's thought, his letter becomes one of the greatest interests for the history of the earliest church and by no means without relevance for today. There have indeed been times in history of the church, especially in its revivals, when Jude was not far from being the most relevant book in the New Testament. So I think it behooves us perhaps to look at that. Now again, it's important to remember that at that point in time, when Jude was writing this, you didn't have all these different churches that called themselves Christian. You could walk into Rome, or Ephesus, Corinth, Jerusalem, and if you ask for the followers of the way, they would point you to one place. It wasn't, you know, Sunday worshipers over there, Trinity believers over there, heaven and hell believers over there. One place, one denomination. So let's go to the book of Jude. There's only one chapter in Jude. Jude, right there at the end, close to Revelation. Borders Revelation here. So Jude, verse 1 and 2. The greetings, Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to whom are called, sanctified by God and the Father, and preserved in Jesus Christ, mercy, peace, and love be multiplied to you. So this is his greeting. Jude is the English word, English rendering of the name Judas. Now there are several Judases that are mentioned in the New Testament, but most scholars agree that Jude or Judas was a half-brother of Jesus Christ. Actually mentioned in Matthew 13, verse 55, lists the brothers of Christ. But it isn't interesting in his greeting here, he doesn't claim that he's Christ's brother. Instead, he says, I'm the brother of James. And from this, we see that Jude was a humble man, wasn't he? He's not name-dropping, you know, to claim relationship with the Messiah. He doesn't do that. Instead, though, he aligns himself with his brother James. Now, everyone at that time knew this relationship. But we see here he never flaunted it. You know, I am Jude, brother of Jesus. He didn't do that. No, see, he considered it more important to be a bond servant of Jesus Christ rather than a blood brother to him. Also note here the audience. Those called and set apart by God and protected by the blood of Jesus Christ. He's addressing the church. That one denomination at that time. Verse 3. Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. So he's basically saying, you know, I had other thoughts in mind that I was going to write to you about, but he changed his mind. There's an urgency to this situation that he is seeing. Notice here, he urges the church to defend the faith that had been entrusted to them. Highlights the importance of holding fast for fighting for that thing that had been delivered, that true message that had come through Jesus Christ to the apostles. And then now he tells us the reason for his concern. Verse 4, for certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turn the grace of our God into lewdness and deny the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. See, at this point in time, you had a new form of Christianity that was attempting to infiltrate the church. Remember, there was only that one denomination at that time. There was a purity, there was still a wholeness about the church. But Jude sees things. He sees that they're beginning to change. And he says that these people have come in amongst you, peaceably, quietly. You know, even to the extent it appears that they are part of the church. They profess the name of Jesus Christ. They considered themselves followers of the way, the church. But upon examination, along with the passage of time, it was becoming apparent there was actually a different standard that was beginning to appear. So these people, as Jude says here, they distort God's grace. They take God's unmerited pardon, that favor that he has toward us, that favor that comes through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and he says they turn it into a license to do all kinds of things. And you think about it, it's an argument that we hear quite a bit today. You know, we're under grace. That law has been done away with. We now have freedom from that law to do all kinds of things, you know, because God's mercy, his grace applies, covers everything. And when you do that, suddenly things that were considered immoral or even sinful are now okay. Lewdness, it says this word lewdness, and we don't see that word much today, do you? The King James Version, if you have the King James Version, it says lasciviousness, a lasciviousness. That's also not a very common word. It's hard to say even. Thayer's Bible Dictionary defines it this way, this lewdness, unbridled lust, excess, lasciviousness, wantonness, outrageousness, shamelessness, insolence, licentiousness. Licentiousness, where you get the word license. In other words, you have given yourself permission, license, to do sinful and immoral things. So what Jude was seeing at that time was that these things were then beginning to spring up within the church under this guise of, hey, it's okay. It's all under the grace of God, under the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And here he's telling them, be careful. Be aware of these things. That there was this new form of Christianity that was beginning to take hold. The grace, the mercy of God was being turned into, you have license to do whatever you want. And it was causing people to distance themselves from what they had previously been taught. This was so concerning to Jude that he changed the message he originally had intended for them. So Jude's instruction to the church was to push back. Push back against these individuals, to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints, to fight for that true message, for the true gospel, the true grace that comes through Jesus Christ. Drop down to verse 11 now. Verse 11. Talking about these people, it says, woe to them, for they've gone the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So he's given this warning to all those that have departed, have deviated from the faith. And notice here he compares them to three biblical figures of the past, Cain, Balaam, and Korah. So here Jude declares a woe. Woe to them. And we see that every once in a while, this woe kind of thing. Woe was a strong term of judgment. So this woe pronounces a judgment, a future calamity, something that is coming. Jude declares a woe on these individuals. Why? Because they have chosen a path of destruction. And he likens them to these three individuals, Cain, Balaam, and Korah, in the things that they're doing. Again, this is the church in its purest form. When there's only that one denomination, and so you have these people, they have differing ideas that are coming in the church. They are in the church already. So although there has always been the church, we're seeing now at this point in time, there are variations, there are splits that are beginning to form. New denominations are beginning to gel. They're calling themselves the church, and yet they weren't. And it's very subtle at the very beginning. But these things were beginning to form. So the question is, what is there about Cain, Balaam, and Korah that earned them that title there, that you would relate these false brethren to these three gentlemen? What was it about them that pertains to us today? And indeed, even to the end of the age. So what I want to do is I want to take some time today to consider these three individuals. See how not only did Jude use them, but how these things apply to us today in the Church of God. Let's begin with Cain. So what does Jude mean when he says, "Woe to those that have gone the way of Cain"? What is the way of Cain? Let's go back and look. Genesis 4. Genesis 4, we're familiar that Cain committed the first murder in the Bible. He rose up, he slew his brother Abel. But there was actually a way of Cain, and that's what we want to look at, a mindset that then led to these actions. Genesis 4, verse 1 and 2. Genesis 4, verse 1. Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived. She bore Cain and said, "I have acquired a man from the Lord." And she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep. Cain was a tiller of the ground. So Cain and Abel were brothers. That's very apparent here. And you read the commentary, and they will hint, suggest they were possibly twins. The reasoning is, you know, she conceived once and bore twice. That it's mentioned here. So it's very possible they were twins. So you have one brother that's a farmer. You have the other that's a sheep herder. Lived two very different lifestyles. Let's continue on. Verse 3. In the process of time, it came to pass, Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel brought of the first fruits of his flock and of their fat. The Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he didn't respect Cain and his offering. Cain was very angry. His countenance fell. Notice here what Cain and Abel were doing. They're presenting sacrifices. They're worshiping God. Now, as we know, God has standards when it comes to worshiping Him. There's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And so you have this scenario here, these two brothers. They're coming before God. They're worshiping God by presenting these sacrifices. So you have to assume in all of this, somewhere along the line, God had given them instructions for worshiping Him, for offering these sacrifices. They clearly knew what they were doing. It wasn't the first time. But beyond the act of sacrifice, what they were to offer is clearly relevant to God as well. As we know, they brought two very different offerings. Abel brought the firstborn of the sheep and their fat. Cain brought fruits and vegetables. And I've heard sermons before that talked about, you know, the kind of sacrifice and which was good and which one was bad or anything. I'm not even going to get into that. I've heard that before. But I think that it comes down to God's instruction for how he was to be worshipped. Abel's form of worship pleased God. Cain's did not. Verse 6 and 7 now. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." So there's a standard. And the standard is there so that you do well. To deviate from that standard would mean that neither he nor his offering was acceptable. So God told Cain that, you know, making up your own rules, instead of following my rules, that doesn't lead you to a good place. It's not acceptable. Now, I believe Cain wanted to worship God. He wanted to present an offering to God, but according to what seemed best to him. on his terms instead of the terms that God had prescribed. So Cain thought God should have accepted his offering because that's what felt good to him. And when God rejected him, Cain becomes angry. And so his extended jealousy then spreads out to his brother. As a result, it was murder that welled up within his heart. And God says, if you don't do well, sin lies at the door. That's exactly what happened. That's the progression that Cain went down. Rose up against Abel, he killed him. And as a result, God cast him away from that place and from his family. So it's this same attitude then that Jude was seeing that was creeping into this one denomination. During his time at 65, 70 AD, something like that. And it's a big enough problem here that Jude feels he needs to address it. And he said, woe to those that go the way of Cain. See, it was those who took their relationship with God, that relationship that he gladly offered to them, and they turned it around to suit their desires. They're molding God to fit what they think God should be. They made it fit in a way that made them feel good. They believed in God. They may even have had faith in God to some degree. But they took it upon themselves to decide what was right, what was wrong, just like Satan did. And see, when you did that, then sin lies at the door, as God had told Cain. Destruction is ultimately the result of that. As we know, this attitude wasn't stopped. Today, it is still a major problem within Christianity. Have all these different denominations, they're doing their own thing, they're going their own way, and you have all these people worshiping God according to what feels good to them, according to what feels right to them. We can't judge anyone's heartfelt sincerity. They're doing it the best they know how. We're clearly told by God how he wants to be worshiped. But when you decide for yourselves how we should worship God, guess what? We're going the way of Cain. Was an issue in Jude's day. Still an issue that's very much alive and well today. Let's look at the second example that Jude has. And it's called the error of Balaam. The error of Balaam. So what is that? What is the error of Balaam? Now we'll see here in a minute, but in the Old Testament, Balaam was a prophet of the true God. But what made him a little bit different, he wasn't an Israelite. And that can get confusing at times. He was from Mesopotamia. But see, God appeared to him. God gave him visions. God spoke to him, told him what to say. And so as the children of Israel, they were on the move to the promised land. They came upon then the region of Moab and Midian. And as they're approaching the residents there, they're very much afraid because they had seen what Israel had done to the Amorites. And so as the Moabites, the Midianites, they see this horde of people coming into their land, they sought ways to weaken them. How can we, you know, destroy them? How can we prevent them? How can we preserve ourselves? So the king of Moab, a guy by the name of Balak, he calls upon the prophet Balaam, and he offers him this great reward in exchange if he would come and curse Israel. Now, at his core, Balaam was a greedy guy. The idea of a reward, that sounded really good to him. But at the same time, he knew he couldn't do anything if God didn't approve of it. Let's go to Numbers 22, and that's where we find the story here. I'm not going to go through the whole story, just generally here. But in Numbers 22, what you see, Balak had sent a delegation to Balaam to ask him to come and curse the children of Israel. Balaam had turned him down because God told him, don't do it. Now, Balak, he's not deterred, so he sends another delegation, a larger delegation with more important people, bigger prizes. Now, at this time, Balaam's really torn because he likes the idea of this reward, but at the same time, he knows he can only say what God tells him to say. So Balaam tells this delegation, spend the night. I'm going to consult with God. I'll give you the answer in the morning. See if perhaps God won't allow him to go. Let's pick up the story, Numbers 22, verses 20 and 21. Verse 20 and 21 said, God came to Balaam at night, and he said to him, if the men come to you, or call you, come to call you, rise and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So Balaam arose in the morning, saddled his donkey, went with the princes of Moab. So God came to Balaam in this vision, and he says, you know, if they come and ask you, then you can go. But see, the problem was, is when you look at it, Balaam didn't give them that chance to come and to ask him. He got up really early. He saddled his donkey. By the time they got up, he's ready to go. They didn't even have to ask him. He disobeyed what he had been told. And what happened? Verse 22. Then God's anger was aroused because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. God's not happy. Balaam disobeyed him. So he sends this angel with a sword to block the path. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but Balaam is on his donkey. The donkey can see the angel. Balaam cannot. So the donkey sees the angel, and he veers off into the field because the angel's standing there with a sword. And for his efforts, the donkey is beaten. Then as they continue on, the place gets really narrow, and I guess it's between two vineyards, and there were walls on every side. And again, the angel appears there, and the donkey veers off and tries to get around the angel. And in doing so, he mashes Balaam's foot. And for his trouble, he's beaten again. Finally, we see a third time. The path gets so narrow, the donkey can't veer from one side to the other. And so she just lays down and is beaten for it. And what's amazing in the story now, the donkey is given the ability to speak. And she begins questioning Balaam. Why are you hitting me? And see, at this time too, Balaam's eyes are now opened so that he can see the angel now. He has an aha moment. Verse 32, drop down to verse 32 now. Numbers 22, 32. The angel of the Lord said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. In other words, you disobeyed what God said to do. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have killed you by now and let her live. That's got to get your attention, doesn't it? Verse 34, Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now, therefore, if it displeases you, I'll turn back. Balaam is forced here to admit. He kind of fudged the rules just a bit, you know, with what God had told him. Because of that, he had sinned. Now, notice here, he doesn't say, I'm sorry, I sinned. You know, you caught me. I'll go back if you want me to. At least he volunteered to go back. Instead, though, he's instructed to go on. And we go on with the story, and Balaam then goes on to Moab. When he shows up, Balak is thrilled. He's finally going to get his curse on the children of Israel. There's great pomp and ceremony. The altars are built, sacrifices are made. And then when it comes time for Balaam to issue that curse, what comes out of his mouth? A blessing upon the children of Israel. Doesn't make Balak very happy. This actually happens three times. You know, Balaam's, I got it this time. And they go through everything again, and he stands up and issues a blessing. Three blessings for Israel. Finally, Balak has had enough. tells Balaam, pack your bags, forget about it, go home. I don't need you here. And even then, before he parts, Balaam offers up a fourth blessing upon the children of Israel. Now you have to understand here, at his core, Balaam is a little bit wicked. Even though he's a prophet of God, God had spoken to him. God declared various prophecies through him. But in his heart, he was more than ready and willing to sell out Israel for a reward. He wasn't there just to serve God. He was also there to serve himself. Balaam didn't want to give up on all these rewards, all these riches. So instead, he hatches up a scheme where he could sell out Israel, he could bring a curse on them, and receive his reward money. And so he conspired with Balak. All Moab and Midian would have to do was to get Israel to sin. And if they were sinful, then God himself would punish them. They wouldn't have to issue any curses. It was actually a pretty easy proposition, unfortunately, when it came down to it. So Balaam advises Moab and Midian on how to entice Israel to sin with harlotry and idolatry. Let's notice that in Numbers 25, verse 1 and 2. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate, and they bowed down to their gods. It's a big party. That's what you see here. You know, let's send all of our beautiful women into the camp of Israel. Let's entice these guys. Let's give them a little food, give them a little bit to drink. Let's have them worship our God, who was Baal. And by the way, Israel, notice here, when we worship Baal, that's a whole lot more fun than how you worship your God. So what was the result of this big party? Verse 3. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. So it worked as Balaam had wanted. I'll get Israel to sin, God will punish them. So now his judgment does come upon the people of Israel. 24,000 men die as a result of this. That's a lot of people, 24,000. It's a tragic story, not only prophet Balaam, but also because the nation of Israel was so easily turned from God. So it's tragic on different levels. So the error of Balaam was pretty straightforward. There was a prophet of God who God was willing to use in his service. This prophet had gifts. He had abilities. He had talents. And yet he was willing to use those talents, those abilities, his God-given gifts to profit himself if he had a chance to do so. In fact, he didn't feel bad using God's given gifts to turn on the children of Israel because it meant his own personal gain. So the doctrine of Balaam is a false concept where one can cooperate with the ways of the world and yet still serve God. And actually teaches at its very core compromise. That was the error of Balaam. Take what God has given you, compromise with the world, use it for your own personal gain. So this doctrine of Balaam runs actually all the way into the book of Revelation. It's actually listed as a defilement of God's people at the time of the end. Let's go there. Revelation 2, verse 14. Talking about the different churches here. And I think we have come to understand that, you know, there is a progression of these churches, and that's one way of looking at it. But there's also the way of looking at it is you have all these ideas from all these churches would also be extent through time. Revelation 2, verse 14. This is the letter to the church at Pergamos. Verse 14. I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols to commit sexual immorality. So God himself says that this attitude, this doctrine of Balaam, would still be there. So somewhere between when Jude wrote, some almost 2,000 years ago, and the return of Jesus Christ, lies the church today. So this same attitude is present today. And it's something we need to be aware of. Jude said, watch out for that attitude. And so that warning comes down to us today to watch out, because it's out there. It's in the church today. It's a doctrine that's going to seem enticing to some, but as Jude said, in the end, its way is of destruction. Let's look at the third warning from Jude, verse 11, where he said, woe to those who perish in the rebellion of Korah. Woe to those who perish in the rebellion of Korah. So what's that all about? What is the rebellion of Korah? Go back to Numbers, Numbers 16 this time. Numbers 16, dealing with the children of Israel again. Numbers 16, verses 1 through 3. Numbers 16, beginning in verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, and then it goes through the sons of all these different people. He took men. So Korah, he takes these men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and they said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? So there's an accusation that is now brought in front of Moses. This accusation is, you know, you Moses, you Aaron, you've taken authority upon yourself. You have set yourselves up above us. Isn't everybody holy? Aren't we all on equal footing here? Aren't we all the brethren? Who put you in charge anyway? So that's the accusation. You look at it, that's really no small accusation, is it? Continue on, verses 4 through 7 now. Moses recognizes it right away. When Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his, who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. The one that he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Do this. Take censers, Korah, and all your company. Put fire in them, put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the Holy One. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. So we see the real problem here. Self-willed men seeking to take upon themselves something that wasn't theirs, something that God had not given to them. They sought a position. The position wasn't theirs to take. So besides their contention from Moses leading the nation, they're also disputing Aaron's position as a high priest. So instead of taking upon himself, what does Moses do? Turns it over to God. He said, if you're so bold as to try to usurp the authority that God has given, that he has established, let's let God decide. He's a big boy. He can handle this. Drop down. Let's continue on, verse 8 through 10. Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it a small thing that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the works of the tabernacle of the Lord, to stand before the congregation to serve them, that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you. And are you seeking the priesthood also? So what you have to realize here is Korah and his family, his clan, even though they were of the tribe of Levi, they were not priests. But they did have duties. They had important duties. They took the tabernacle down. They packaged it all up when they traveled. All the utensils, everything that went with it. When they got where they were going, they set it all up. They guarded the place. They made sure that people didn't wander into it. They had responsibilities. They had duties. They were important, if you will. And yet, you see, they wanted more. Here this says they wanted to take on the duties of the priesthood. So Moses here, he's reminding them, you already have a job. You have an important responsibility. But they wanted more. They wanted it all. Verse 11. Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron that you should complain against him? So the challenge wasn't only against just Moses, it was also against Aaron. But when you look at it, they were actually gathering against God. They were gathering against what he had established. Verse 12, Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but he said, we will not come up. So you got more people here, the sons of Eliab, who were also open to rebellion. So they're also rebellious. So you fast forward through the story, and next morning, 250 of these leaders with their censers, with fire and incense, they show up at the tabernacle. And from there, things happen quickly. They happen very powerfully. Drop down to verse 25. Moses rose, he went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in their sins. So they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out. They stood at the door of the tents with their wives, their sons, their little children. And Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them out of my own will. If these men die naturally, like all men, or if they're visited by a common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand these men have rejected the Lord. And it came to pass, as he finished speaking these words, the ground split apart under them. The earth opened its mouth, swallowed them up with their household, all these men with Korah and all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. All Israel that were around fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. And a fire came out from the Lord, consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. God's choice is clear. He showed who he was working through. He showed who he had set up to be in charge. And you read through that account and you begin to, you know, in your mind's eye, picture what that must have looked like. The rebellion of Korah demonstrates a dire consequence of rejecting the authority not only of God, but of those that he has set to be his leaders. And there's an irony in this, and I see it, and I know all the time, perhaps you've noticed this as well. When people make a proclamation of some injustice against them, many times their problem is the exact same thing that they're accusing the others of. Korah accused Moses, taking too much upon yourself, when in fact it was he that wanted to take everything upon himself. So the characteristics of these false teachers within the church includes different things like pride, selfishness, greed, disregard for the will of God. Just like Korah, they disregard the plan of God. They're insubordinate to God's appointed authorities. So that was the rebellion of Korah. It's a message that Jude gave as part of what the church was to watch out for themselves. Even in their midst, this disregard for God's plan, this insubordination against his appointed authority. You know, these a lot of times you see, and Korah was this way, they're proud about it. They may even claim that, you know, my rebellion is a spiritual gift. God chose me. Come follow me. They aim to dismantle the existing authority and then set themselves up as the authority instead. Jude said, woe to those individuals. He warned the church against following after those lead. The end again, who would be destruction. So at the beginning of the New Testament church, the Christian community was the church of God. It was followers of the way, if you will. And that was it. But from that sprang out this broad spectrum of what we have in the world around us today. How many churches exist in this world because you have someone stand up and decide they want to take on the role of authority? You know, I'll just go out on my own. These people will follow me. I'm important. They're going to listen to me. It's happened time and time and time again throughout the history of the world. Even within the Church of God, it has happened. The warning of Jude is to beware, to contend earnestly for that faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Now, what's interesting is the Apostle Peter wrote something very similar. And he wrote, when you look at it, his second epistle was written about the same time as Jude's, somewhere in the time frame 65-70 A.D. He also warned the church of very similar dangers that would rise up amongst them. Let's look at Peter's account, 2 Peter 2, verses 1 through 3. 2 Peter 2. Second Peter 2, beginning in verse 1. Peter writes this. He said, there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. Does this sound like Jude? Verse 2. Many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle. Their destruction does not slumber. If you remember, Jude said, woe to those that would go down this path. So you take people from the very beginning of the Bible, go through history, and you see all these different attitudes. And we see Jude brought those out. They're still within the church today. And Jude said, woe to these people. We're 2 Peter. Drop down to verse 12, verses 12 through 17 now. Peter says, but these, like natural brute beasts, made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil things they do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption. They will receive the wages of unrighteousness at those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deception while they feast with you. Having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, they have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. They have forsaken the right way, gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his iniquity. A dumb donkey, speaking with a man's voice, restrained the madness of the prophet. These are wells without water, clouds carried by tempest, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. Very similar to what Job had talked about, isn't it? Peter's saying these attitudes, they're there. They're rising up in the midst of the church. There weren't other churches. You know, if you had a different perspective, you didn't go anywhere. There was only the one church. But you had these people that were trying to bring up these differences within the one true church. Peter says, they're in your midst. You need to watch out. So the church of that day was the only following of Jesus Christ. Slowly over the centuries, you had these false teachers that would come in. And they would go out from there and they would begin their own denominations. They would, with their own teachings. And they would spawn many different brands of Christianity. That's exactly what has come down to us today. So we know there's only one truth by which we're to worship God. God is spirit. Those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. We must be able to do what he says. Jesus Christ said the Father is seeking such people to worship him. Let's continue on, verse 18 through 22. It says, for when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through lewdness. We see lewdness again, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage. For if, after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. But it has happened to them, according to the true proverb, a dog returns to its own vomit, and a sow having washed it to her wallowing in the mire. So he's saying there's an especial danger here for those that have been illuminated by the light of Christ. Those people, if they are illuminated, those, if they're dragged back into the darkness, they came from darkness into light, but now they're being enticed and they're being pulled back into darkness. And he says it's worse for them afterward than it was in the beginning. That's why we have to take it so seriously. That's why the judgment comes down so seriously upon them. Jude said to be aware of those that would use grace as a rallying cry. That rallying cry to return people to that darkness, to the lewdness, that bondage again. Now we live in an age where there's every flavor of Christianity on display in the world around us. And in some cases, it actually embraces things that God's word describes as abomination, as sin in his sight. And in the end, it's not Christianity at all. We've been blessed to understand that. We know the vast majority of Christianity has been blinded. You know, the scales have not been removed from their eyes. So the warning from Peter and Jude both is the same. We are not to immerse ourselves in the ways of those that are blind. Christianity today isn't true Christianity of the New Testament church. It is not the same Christianity of that one denomination. Instead, it is morphed into this twisted up mess of man's desires. Now, all they did was simply slap a Christian label upon it. This false Christianity is men saying, I worship God in a way that's best for me. Eat, drink, and be merry, according to how I see things. This Christianity today is men saying, I know there's money to be had, and I'm going to use this gift that I have been given, and I'll use my position, I'll use my congregation to enrich myself. Christianity today is men saying, hey, I'm the one. Follow me. It was a warning in the days of Jude and Peter. It's also the warning for us in the church today. Jude and Peter warned the church in their time. There was this new brand of Christianity that was coming, and then it would draw many people after it. And then we can fast forward some 2,000 years, and here we are at the very broad end of that funnel, 45,000 different denominations from a very specific focal point where the only option for Christianity was the Church of God. It's to the point today, true church is only a very small percentage of the Christian world. The warning is for the church to beware. We always have to be on guard against it. We have to be aware of these things, you know, that they can creep in from the outside. We have to realize that this world holds grace and liberty as that license. We have to be aware of that as well. The warning is beware. The Apostle Paul wrote in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 7, he said, "The mystery of lawlessness is already at work." It was threatening the church in his day. It's a very real risk to the church in our day as well. Now, the Bible tells us in the future, a very major religious revival. It's going to arrive on the scene at the end of the age. That's definitely where we're headed, is the end of the age. This religious revival will seem very good to many, because at that point in time, the world is going to be in turmoil. It's going to be desperate. It's going to be searching for an answer. And then on the scene will come this very strong political and religious power that will seem to have all the answers. And people are going to gravitate toward it. It's going to seem good to the people of the world. And Christ even told us it's even going to seem good to some within the churches of God. But we have to understand its path is the path to destruction. Because that beast is going to have the appearance of a lamb. It's going to speak with the voice of the dragon. We have to be able to hear these things. We have to be able to discern them. So that system is going to look religious. It's going to look holy. It will promise grace and liberty. And it's even going to proclaim the very name of Jesus Christ. But in its end will be the end of death. Jude's warning to the church is beware. Beware of those that deviate from the true message of the gospel, while at the same time promising liberty, grace. Jude's instruction is that you and I need to take to heart today. Never stop contending earnestly for the true faith, for the faith of God through Jesus Christ to the church that was once for all delivered to the saints. See, that's the foundation we have to stand on today and in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins, for that wonderful message. All right, brethren, if you would, please rise and join me in one final.